It was Henry David Thoreau who said, "We cannot make our days longer, but we can surely make our coffee better." During the course of this election, I've spoken to many of you about your many concerns. I spoke with Eliza Ramirez, who loves fresh coffee, but has no way of knowing the freshness of the coffee she purchases. I spoke with sophomore Reggie Banks, who loves drinking only the best coffee, but also loves the convenience of front door delivery. When you cast your vote for Sparkplug Coffee, you're casting a vote for premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded with blends and roasts to suit any taste. You're casting a vote for front door delivery to your home or office within a week of custom roasting. When you cast a vote for Sparkplug Coffee, you're casting a vote for yourselves. So plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com. Thank you.
Top 100 Project.
And action.
Thanks for checking out our podcast, Flickr Show fans, as the next 100 Project enters its 11th month of reviewing good old movies. If spoilers aren't your jam, as Bev would say, you should check out the movie before we wreck every centimeter of it. I am Ryan Ellis, the former class president. I really was. And with me on the tattered blue IKEA couch is my overachieving co-host and wife, Bev.
That's me.
Pick flick. Obviously, I've got a bit of a voice thing going on here. I'm getting over one hell of a bad cold. I couldn't speak at all a few days ago, so forgive the voice. I haven't sounded like this since, I think it was All About Eve from the 1950s. We were doing the Top 100 Project movies, All About Eve and Singing in the Rain, that kind of era. We both sounded pretty bad back then.
It's whenever we're doing movies about very ambitious women.
I hate ambitious women.
They make you sick.
Well, we hope we can soldier through this and not be too unbearable or too unlistenable. So the coming attraction trivia for this week's picture, Election. The female stars in each of Alexander Payne's first two movies later co-starred in the same film many years later. What was that movie?
Well, the stars were Reese Witherspoon, obviously, in Election, and the movie before that was Citizen Ruth, starring Laura Dern 2 years ago, I think. They were both in Wild, where Laura Dern played Reese Witherspoon's mother.
And they're both nominated for Oscars, which is one of the reasons I thought of this in the first place, because Payne himself has been nominated for a bunch of them since he got going in the mid-90s with Citizen Ruth and then beyond. And those two, yeah, in Payne movies, and then they are in the same one, getting nominations many years later. All right, the next 100 Project's 38th picture with motion, Election, was not nominated for anything AFI-wise. Nothing. Paramount released the movie in late April and then into May of 1999, one of my favorite movie years. Despite very nice critical reviews, the movie lost money for Paramount. Bev, explain the movie for people who aren't familiar anymore with The Skinny.
Reese Witherspoon is high school mega overachiever Tracy Flick. Matthew Broderick is Jim McAllister, the history and civics teacher in her Omaha school. After Tracy's previous affair with Jim's best friend got the friend fired, Jim doesn't want to deal with Tracy in her obsessive quest to become class president. Instead, he convinces popular athlete Paul Metzler, played by Chris Klein, to run against her.
Or, in a nutshell, if you started life in Omaha and ended up in New York City, you should thank Tracy Flick.
Good point.
Working for the Natural History Museum as well, one of our favorite museums in New York. We've seen a lot of the big ones, or all the big ones at least. That's the only one I really want to see again. That may be the Met, I guess, actually. We still haven't seen all of the Mets by two visits there. So good for him to have had that happen, although he does have one hell of a small apartment in New York.
Yes, and he's a tour guide.
He's teaching.
He's back in education.
Okay, the Rotten Tomatoes numbers on Election, 92% of them liked it, 97 fresh, 8 rotten, but only 79% of audiences. And like I said, the movie did not succeed. It was 98th at the 1999 U.S. box office. Star Wars The Phantom Menace and The Sixth Sense were the big hits of 1999. Bev, tell people what you think about Election, a film that you decided to do, and I think you made a good choice to do the day before the American election.
Yes, I think it's a black comedy masterpiece. I am alarmed that it got 79% from audiences
stupid
on Rotten
people.
Tomatoes.
Stupid people.
But I just don't even, honestly, I'm struggling to wrap my head around what about it would have turned people off. Maybe just, it's a little dark and there's no real hero. Everybody's kind of bad when it comes down to it. But it's quick, it's smart, insightful. It's full of pathos, even for these flawed characters. And it's hysterical. I've seen it like a dozen times over the past 17 years, and it is still relevant, sharp as a tack. It takes new shades in the context of what's happening in American politics right now. The very obvious parallels between Tracy Flick and Hillary Clinton. I think it's earned a place as one of my very favorite films. Like, I might put it in my top 10.
And she is your junior Hillary Clinton, right?
I'm not the first person to say it, and I won't be the last. As a matter of fact, Reese Witherspoon answered a question in a presser once. Somebody asked her, would you ever play Hillary Clinton? Because I guess she would be an obvious choice. And she said, well, I already have, referring to this performance. And she met Clinton once. She said the first thing that Clinton said to her was, people are always telling me that I remind them of Tracy Flick.
I never heard that until you mentioned it, but I do like the comparison. I'm going to tell you why I think people didn't like this movie in 1999 and maybe not that much since on home video, because you've got two despicably human lead characters. They're very sympathetic, but Jim and Tracy are despicable, and they're both liars. They're both very self-involved. Well, yeah. Especially her, but him too.
And self-serving.
And he's the one in the beginning of the movie who's a hero to everybody in that school. He's the most popular teacher. Was it something like 3 years in a row?
Mm-hmm.
And then he does something terrible, lies and cheats, just because he doesn't want to work with her. And then the subtext is not very subtle. He doesn't like her, granted, but he also is terrified that she's going to seduce him. Well, not to blame the kid, but, you know, that he thinks she's going to seduce him.
He's afraid of his own attraction.
Because of what happened to Dave. Yeah. And then he pictures her while he's fucking his wife, just like he pictures his best friend's wife while he's fucking his wife. And that seems to be what gets him off. He's hate fucking when he pictures her especially. And I just love the way that both of them, with Linda, it's Jim, fuck me. And it's kind of a matter of fact, not all that sexy. The wife is sexier than what she's saying, really. And then when it's Tracy, it's, fuck me, Jim. Yeah, Mr. McAllister. Fuck me. And it's not the least bit sexy. But the look on Broderick's face is, that's going to get me off.
Yeah, and he's intimidated by his attraction to her. He blames her for getting his best friend fired, even though I think they say she's a freshman when it happened. Nobody in their right mind would hold her responsible. And the way it's portrayed in the film, she truly isn't at fault. It truly is Dave that seduces her. She's kind of innocent, being led down the path by him. You see him take her hand and lead her to the bedroom, and she's all trepidatious and afraid. It's not even her that turns him in. It's her mother when she finds the little booklet that he made for her, trying to get her to go to Hawaii with him. Oh, God. But I agree with you. I think that what turns people off is just how fundamentally flawed and unlikable these characters are. Most people at the beginning of the film are going to relate to Jim McAllister. Oh, yeah. He's their hero, right? They set it up very much for him to be a hero. And then by the end of the film, you cannot argue that he becomes a despicable, maybe not a despicable, no, he is despicable. Mm-hmm. He's a despicable man. He's doing despicable things. No matter what his voiceover assures us that he's doing the right thing, that everything, his motives are pure, he is cheating on his wife with his best friend's ex. He is sabotaging this, not just ambitious girl, but this competent girl who totally deserves.
She's the one you want to be in charge of things, just like Hillary Clinton would be the one you want,
you know,
to be in charge of things.
People always complain about Hillary Clinton. She's so prepared, as if it's a flaw. And that's definitely true of Tracy Flick, too. Like, you can be kind of resentful that this person is outperforming everyone else in the school and shows up before anybody else is there with cupcakes or whatever she's done. She's so hardworking. She's so overprepared. And there's something about that that puts people off, but it's also exactly the kind of person you want in charge. Because when she's in charge and she loves being the leader, what does she say? She has a line where she's like, and everything will go great as long as everybody just does what I say. She loves being in charge, but she also deserves to be in charge. She does the work. Things run smoothly when she's in charge.
And Paul would not have been a very good class president from a competence standpoint, just from a popularity and likability standpoint. And had Tammy not disqualified herself, she would have deliberately, she even says so, not even had a government. She probably would have tried to dissolve it if that's even possible. Maybe they wouldn't have allowed her to do that. Let's talk about the election and those three people, because they're the ones that run for president. When Jim cheats by throwing out two of the votes to let Paul win, the irony of all of that is that had Paul not been such a nice gentleman and said, oh, I'll vote for Tracy, he would have won. That would have been the two-vote swing. And yet they say that the protest votes, I think they call them that, they outnumbered the votes for Tracy and for Paul. So if Tammy hadn't gotten herself expelled by lying about being the one who stole the posters, or ripped the posters down, I should say, then she might have won. So Jim's whole chicanery is bad, and he's the one who gets caught. That janitor is being a real dick. Early in the movie, we see how Jim is trying to clear out the fridge, which is a good deed. He misses the trash can. We don't see him never put the thing in the trash can. I think it's Chinese food.
Mm-hmm.
And the janitor sees that. I guess it's one of those things, it's a Hitchcock answer. Well, how do we have some kind of climax? How do we ever find out that these votes were in the trash unless the janitor finds it? And why does he do that? and rat out Jim because he's pissed at him for really a weak reason.
Okay, but that is the way the film opens. I think it's a great expression of the theme of the film. You know, the theme of the film is we are all convinced we are heroes, when in actuality, we are very likely villains, or at the very least, selfish. Now, he is a hero, he's doing a good deed, he's cleaning out the fridge, but what is he doing? He's actually making more work for somebody else. He's not looking at the garbage, he's making a mess that he's surely not going to clean up.
I don't think that's necessarily true. I think he might have picked up that thing, why not?
But if he had picked it up, then the janitor would have come back, seen a clean floor. He wouldn't have turned him in if there had been like a clean floor when he got back. If there hadn't been some kind of careless, thoughtless way that Jim, without thinking about it, we all think about messes in public places, that fairy is going to clean that up. You know, you don't really think about the person who ultimately cleans it up. And I guess we don't know, but it clearly becomes an important part of the film. And it's the introduction of his character doing this thing that spoils the good deed that he's doing. Through the whole film, he always thinks, in his VO, he's always saying what a good person he is and how clean his motives are and how rational his thinking is, and that he is right to bring Tracy down and to destroy her dreams, even though she deserves it.
Well, also just watching porn in the basement, there's a lot of wives out there that'd be appalled by him even doing that.
And what kind of porn is he watching? He's watching student porn, like a cheerleader, a high school student is the star of the porn.
And Tracy's not a cheerleader, but the cheerleader could be Tracy. Definitely, the football player is a stand-in for Paul, who had broken his leg in a ski accident and is no longer a football player.
And we know for a fact is for sure getting laid because he talks about a hilarious line. We'd fucking have a hot tub.
I think it's a key moment with Chris Klein, a very important wrinkle in the whole film, to make him a genuinely nice guy, right down to voting for Tracy in the voting booth. If he wasn't a nice guy, then you have nobody to latch onto as a legit person you can really truly root for, because there are two main characters we don't necessarily fully root for, as we said. Tammy, despite some positive qualities, is somebody you can't really root for because she's a liar to actually hurt her own candidacy. She could have outed Tracy and probably should have, but she's not fully root forable either.
She's only doing it to get back at her brother anyway.
And all he ever does is just get manipulated by the girlfriend that was his sister's girlfriend and by Jim. And then even by himself, by not voting for himself in the election, not knowing, of course, that would make a difference. But if he ever found out somehow that he lost by 2 votes, he might have said, well, that's the way it should have been. That's destiny. Tracy still deserved to win. It was the unlikable nerd versus the popular jock. And the irony is that that jock is guided by a popular nerd. Jim McAllister is a nerd in his own right.
Yes.
This is the guy that played Ferris Bueller, of course. We covered that movie quite a few months ago. And now this is what Broderick came into. He didn't really do that many big movies until he did Godzilla the year before this, which nobody really talks about him in that, but he was the main actor. Then he did this. Then the year after that, he did You Can Count on Me, where he plays another unlikable schlub boss.
And I think the same year as the election, he did Inspector Gadget, which I'm sure he made more money for, but nobody is ever talking about that movie.
That could have taken off. Who's to say? It was a pretty popular TV series, but it just didn't work. A lot of those kinds of things didn't back then. It's not really a superhero movie, but it might have really taken off if they made it last year, for all we know. Because of all those kinds of movies that have succeeded so well.
Alexander Payne, the director, cast him intentionally to draw upon that Ferris Bueller persona. He wanted him back in school, only this time playing an authority figure who is respected.
And then Jim ruins that glowing reputation he had when the movie started because he's only worried he's going to try to fuck Tracy, I think is what it really comes down to. He can't even trust himself. We just talked about Ferris Bueller a second ago. Is it deliberate casting that they made his wife, Diane, I think, look like Jeannie Bueller? The sister.
Yeah, she looks like the actress who played his sister, who in real life was his girlfriend. Yep. They dated in the real life. Yeah. I don't know if that was intentional or not. That would be a weird thing to draw upon to make it seem like he married his sister.
I don't think the movie's implying that he married his sister, but that she just looks enough like her.
So let's just talk about Jim McAllister as a character and whether or not he should be envious of Tracy and her ambition and the fact that she's going to go somewhere. What reason does he have to be resentful of a student like Tracy? Why does he hate her? He goes out of his way to paint this Norman Rockwell picture of his life in his voiceover, and he seems genuinely happy, not just in his voiceover, but in what you're shown by the film, because what they showed frequently doesn't match up with what the voiceover tells us. But in the beginning of the film, when he says, I love being a teacher, and I have this wife that I love, and this home, and this life in Omaha, and it's a good life. And it is a good life.
Well, the marriage is the one thing that is the irony. It's the Citizen Kane kind of thing, where, what'd you say? Nothing.
Yeah, and they've been married for 9 years.
Maybe it's not a Citizen Kane comparison, because, of course, is the infamous... The marriage breaks down in various pans and cuts. But yes, he's talking about how we're together through thick and thin. We're a team. And they don't say a word at dinner. Except for, did you say something? No. But other than that, yeah, he does seem to be legit and genuine. It is also strange that he's so worked up about this girl who's going to be gone in a few years. If he wants to, he can be there forever. There's nothing wrong with that. A lot of people would say, what a loser. He's a teacher in Omaha. Nothing wrong with that job at all. And she's going to go on to other things. And if it's something great or if it's something not great, what does he care?
Even though we are coming across as though we're fully on Team Tracy, there is something about her right off the bat that is intolerable.
That she wanted to be friends with her father in high school.
No, no. She's a know-it-all and she's arrogant and she's prissy and she's inflexible. She's just insufferable. I wouldn't want to be friends with her. I wouldn't want anything to do with her. Would I want to sabotage her? You kind of don't need to sabotage her. She's lonely. She's not a happy person. You can believe that at some point in her life, she will finally find her tribe and her place where her personality is appreciated.
In politics in Washington.
Yeah, probably in politics in Washington. Although, I don't know, where did she go to school? Duke? She gets there and she discovers that they're all just a bunch of burnouts. The same loser she left behind in high school somehow managed to follow her to university in that great shot of her in her pink pajamas with her hair and foam curlers like my mom used to wear, telling everybody, shut up! She has studying to do! You don't like her. If you see it on paper, she's the hero. She's the person we should root for. She's the one that works hard and deserves it.
But the key scene for her is when she is caught. Well, Jim doesn't know, but he thinks that she's the one that tore the posters down. And that's also dumb, too, on her part. One poster didn't hang properly for her. There's probably 400 posters by all of them, especially by her, but Paul's got a lot of them, and Tammy does, too, in the whole school. People aren't that stupid. They don't need 200 posters every hallway to be reminded, oh, yeah, there's an election later this week, or later this month, whatever it was, and these are the people running. I mean, for Christ's sake, give people a little credit. But when she tears them all down... She's petty and she's silly and she's stupid. Then when he thinks he's got her caught, it's when Tammy comes in and says, I did it. Because, of course, she saw Tracy throwing them in the trash out where Tammy likes to have her little alone time. But the key part of that scene is that, first of all, Tracy's busted and she knows it, although Jim doesn't have any proof. But she must believe that he does have some kind of proof because he does very matter-of-factly tell her, I think you did it. But then when Tammy's the one who says, I did it, Tracy, right in character, you tore those posters down, I'll get you for this. And it's one of the most important things in the whole film because that is where she's blatantly lying. She wasn't really a liar before that moment. But if she doesn't stay in character, then maybe she does seem guilty. And if she's going to yell at the girl, then she's right in the character she would be, which is, now we know what really happened. And of course, that isn't what really happened.
Well, underneath that very tightly wound persona that she puts across is boiling rage. In the VO over and over, she talks about Paul with this vitriol. She's so resentful that he just seems to have everything handed to him on a silver platter. He's white, male, born rich, parents give him everything. He's driving around in a car. He's popular. He's a talented football player, and he's good looking, and he has a girlfriend, and he has friends, and he might even win the presidency despite not being remotely qualified and barely wanting it. Just through some whim, if he decides he wants it, he can just snatch it. That's probably something that's been happening to her whole life. The personification of Tracy is this notion that even though she does everything right, she follows all the rules, everybody still hates her.
They almost should not have cast a good-looking woman like Reese Witherspoon to play that character, because if she was mediocre-looking, it might have made her more sympathetic. But it's harder to feel sorry for somebody who's already so good-looking in her own right. Yeah, he's the good-looking boy, but I think pound for pound, well, of course, I'm a guy and I prefer her looks anyway, but she's way hotter than he is.
Okay, here's my question, though. Do you find Tracy Flick attractive? I mean, plenty
of
actors...
No, because personalities...
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, but it doesn't help that she is as good-looking as she is, but that's Hollywood for you, because everyone in this movie is at least okay-looking, but then again, a lot of them are from that area, including Klein. He was going to high school in Omaha. This was his first film, and they cast him from... casting sessions in that area.
Wow.
I never thought he was a great actor. He's okay in the American Pie movies. He's actually quite good in We Were Soldiers with Mel Gibson in 2002. He's still acting as far as I can tell, but he hasn't had that many other movies you could really talk about. But he just happened to be in the right place at the right time. And you say good looking, but you compare him to other Hollywood hunks of that age, of that time, or even this time, he's probably mediocre at that
point. He's good looking by Omaha high school standards. Yeah. I can totally see how he would be prom king in an average suburban town. But yeah, by Hollywood standards, I can see what you're saying. I've never seen him do anything better than
This is his best role. It's his first role.
Hysterical.
You got to give credit to the writing, but then actors do have to pull off the writing. Sometimes an actor can be mediocre or bad in everything they do, and then they'll be in that one or a couple of movies maybe, and they'll be great because they happen to find the right writing. I think that he fits that bill. I don't think he's somebody that could rise above mediocre or bad writing, mm-hmm. but when it's written well for him, and the line you just said about, was it a fuck in a hot tub? And,
yes.
And then the girlfriend, I forget her name now, but she goes back and blows him, and the way he says that, he's just so cheerful and matter of fact, he doesn't really have a ton of emotion. He's a nice guy.
He's 100% sincere.
Yes, but if he got worked up in his voiceover, it wouldn't work as well. And speaking of voiceover, we have four different people, Goodfellas-esque, actually times two, because we only have two different voiceovers in Goodfellas, because we have three in Casino, but here you got four. You've got the main, I guess, four characters, actually, because Tammy would be the fourth lead. Yes. And they all have different times where they're the voiceover person. So, in a way, too, that skews our perception. I don't think this is a movie that's actually playing off of what's really going on. I think the movie's telling you, this is the story. It's not like you see something from one point of view, and then you see it later from another point of view and think, oh, Jim was dead wrong, or Tracy was dead wrong.
It's not Rashomon. It's not...
Right, exactly.
Yeah, it's not trying to confuse us or make us question the nature of reality, but it's trying to make us question the nature of the voices in our own heads, because it's so well written that when a character rationalizes their behavior, it sounds a lot like rationalization you or I may have made.
Yeah.
To do something crazy. Everything's a little bit extreme. I mean, it's a comedy, but they all kind of fit these archetypes as well, where we can relate to them in one way or another. We probably are all a little bit Jim McAllister or Tracy Flick or Tammy or Paul. And we've probably all at some point been as clueless as Paul and just disregarding the fact that we have it better than everybody else. Or we've been Jim and thought that we were an absolute hero, even though we were just rationalizing our own selfish behavior.
And also skewing the votes. People wanted Tracy to win. Because she won the vote.
For her.
So
yes.
Then he's also going against what the students want.
Yes, that's true. He's circumventing democracy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's absolutely a villain by the end of the film. But those narrations, they are really well written. They are so, so funny. But they also are almost uncomfortably honest about what goes on in our own heads and the way that we write our own stories.
One of the other characters in the film that gets a lot of screen time is Linda, Dave's ex, and the one that Jim does have at least one sex session with, and then she bails on him when they're supposed to get together later in the day. I think Linda gets off the hook in this movie, and it's maybe on purpose. Maybe Alexander Payne did that very deliberately, because by that point in the story, Jim is going through his Job moment. He's having everything go wrong. But she should pay for fucking him because she betrayed her friend, Diane, by fucking Diane's husband, Jim.
I don't think she ever really wanted Jim, and then she got overwhelmed when she saw how into it he was. There's a line the morning that they fool around when he's fixing something in the bathroom. He's already kind of made this weird little pass at her about going to the hotel.
Yeah.
She says, you know, Dave was a bedwetter. Total non sequitur. Out of nowhere, she says that. And then we all go, oh, she's still furious with her ex-husband. She wants to get back at him. That's why she fools around Jim. She's just doing it to get revenge. And maybe she's mad at Jim, too. Maybe she's mad at Jim for being a lout just like her ex-husband. Maybe she really just thought that he was out of the kindness of his heart helping her out, and he was one of the good ones, and then to be reminded, oh, great, another guy who's not loyal to his wife.
So then even more so, she should be punished in this movie, and she is not.
I agree. I think that she gets let off the hook. She seems to destroy his life and then walk away scot-free and still keep her friend or whatever.
Which is true about Tracy, although she was, I guess, a minor, but certainly too young, and Dave is the grown-up. He was the one that made the mistake.
If she was a freshman, she was 14.
So then she's a minor. Yeah. Maybe that's the male writer, Payne, who is, I don't know if we call him a woman-hater in all of his movies. I don't think he would actually at all. But in these two cases, with Linda and Tracy, maybe that's a part of him that's at least subtextually saying, oh, these fucking chicks, they always get away with it. They fuck over the guys.
These 14-year-old girls always destroy
but also the grown-up
lives.
Woman.
Oh, yes, yes, Linda, too.
That's what I mean. I'm including both here.
Yeah. Is it mean to her? Is it unfair to Tracy, I mean, now? People have raised the question, is election misogynist? Is it hard on Tracy? When I watched the movie in 99, I felt far less complicated about Jim and his behavior as I do now. Now I watch it and I go, oh, Jim's a troll. He does resent her partially because she's a woman. Like, I can't imagine Jim getting this worked up about an overachieving student if it was a dude. Part of his problem with her is that she's a girl, obviously because she was somewhat responsible for his best friend losing his job. Well, she wasn't actually at all.
She was involved at least.
But he resents her almost as much because he's attracted to her.
Well, we said that already. Yeah, right? Three reasons why he hates
her. Which is really unfair to her. That kind of makes him a misogynist.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably fair to say. I don't think everything in pop culture is misogynistic, but when men are the writers and the producers and the directors, more often than not, the studio heads, and then usually the male leads of films, it may not even be deliberate, but it's just the point of view that you've had your whole life, especially when you end your 30s and 40s, like Payne would have been and Broderick was, that you may not look at women as the enemy, but indirectly they are.
Mm-hmm. And there was a couple of stories that came out from the set about him being a real jerk to work with.
Payne was.
Not him, but the assistant director, who is still a very successful assistant director in Hollywood, was flat out accused of sexual harassment and mild sexual assault. Is that even a thing? Mild, yeah. like sexual humiliation on set. This is all from an Exo Jane It Happened to Me article. So that's certainly not admissible in a court of law. I'm not going to sit here and say that I'm behind everything that this woman said, but she said that her experience on Election after 8 or 9 years in Hollywood was what finally drove her away from working in the entertainment industry, and she changed careers because of her experience specifically with Alexander Payne and the assistant director, and that Payne was a bully.
I did not know that. Well, it's not fun to hear, but I'm not surprised really to hear that any director is not the wonderful human being we think they are. We both seem to, I certainly do, idolize Scorsese, but God knows what he's been like in his film sets. I heard that with Casino, I mentioned that movie a few minutes ago, he was calling Sharon Stone the girl. Bring in the girl. Now, maybe that's not true, but if it is, I mean, Sharon Stone was an established star by that point, and she's a grown woman, too, so that's a strange way to do things. And Scorsese wasn't a misogynistic director. He'd had some women in some great roles before that movie, and including that one and some since. So maybe all directors in some way have their quirks that we never learn about that we also would be more bothered by today than we would have been 10 or 15 years ago. And I say we as society because obviously women have a right to be bothered by that always, but men are just more aware than ever. Now let's segue into, and I don't want to talk about this for too long because I hate this goddamn bastard, and hopefully by tomorrow he's out of our hair, but the real election.
Hallelujah, please.
Same deal. Let's elect the competent person and get rid of the charismatic one who doesn't deserve it. But there's a line that Tammy has in the speeches where she says, who cares about this stupid election? And I say, amen. Although then again, obviously it's a very important election in reality we're going to experience tomorrow in America. But the students in this movie bit back their bile and voted for the competent one, meaning Tracy. And I hope to God they do the same thing on November 8th, 2016.
The students at Carver voted for Tammy in a protest vote, which many consider Trump voters to be kind of protest voters, right? Kind of like Brexit voters. So Tammy's the one who just wants to blow up the establishment, and that's the sentiment that is behind a lot of Trump voters. I don't think Trump's going to win, fingers crossed, knock on wood, but Tammy is more of Trump than Paul. Paul's definitely nothing like Trump.
No, of course not. No. He's not somebody who's got a vindictive mean streak and sexist and racist and all the things that Trump shows to be. And because we can learn anything we want to about him and his voiceover, there's nothing hidden about him. He doesn't hate women. He seems like a nice person to everybody.
I agree with what you said earlier that it is a great, I guess, twist in the film that he is so, so nice. Because they really went out of their way to make a character who couldn't possibly deserve this less. He's nice, but he's stupid. He's unambitious. And he's completely, blissfully unaware of all of his own privilege.
Well, Alexander Payne and his co-writer Jim Taylor, and they shared an Oscar for Sideways several years after this, they based the whole story on Tom Parada's 1998 novel, another example of a book being turned into a movie very quickly. But Parada was inspired by Ross Perot's 1992 third-party candidacy, so I guess Ross Perot in this movie is Tammy. Now, Ross Perot has been accused of blowing it for George Bush Sr., just like Nader supposedly blew it for Gore in 2000. I've read stories where neither of those things are actually true. They've done the math on it and thought, no, there weren't enough votes in either case. The Nader thing seems to be more logical that that was true. But isn't that funny? You're based on a real election situation, and then we had a real election, would have been the year after this movie, which was the controversial Bush and Gore one, and now we're talking about an election tomorrow that's also going to be controversial because if Idiot Boyd loses, he's already said, I may not go away. I may protest this. And even if that doesn't happen, the people in politics say they're going to stonewall Hillary Clinton right away with all kinds of investigations. They're not going to confirm Supreme Court nominees and all this other shit, which is their job. And it's her job to find Supreme Court people, including the fact they need one right now, let alone they might need more in a couple of years.
If we ever did an aside podcast about politics, there would be so much swearing.
Well, the whole system in America is very clearly broken, and I think that's what they're parodying here. In a time before, it was clearly broken. You could argue it was not the greatest system for a long time in America, but it certainly is way worse ever since, and they didn't even have money politics at the level that they do now. It wasn't legal, at least, to just go ahead and throw whatever you wanted at somebody the way you can now. And let's not forget, too, a very important part of real politics, not in the movie Election, is not the president. It's these congressmen and the senators and the local politics that set the tone for everything else. The president of a country can only do so much.
Mm-hmm. Since 1999, it's hard to believe how much faith we have lost in the political system. I think the 2000 election, when it really began to go downhill for me, because we weren't alive during Watergate, so we don't really have that as a political reference. But it reminds me of a great moment in the film when Jim McAllister's been fired and he's in traffic and he comes to a red light with the same kid who counted the votes, and it was told that he counted wrong. And his vile reaction to seeing Jim, he rolls down the window of his car just to spit at him, because that's how people react to having their institutions be spoiled for them, to losing faith in institutions like democracy, especially when you're young and you're idealistic and you really believe in it.
That character is so officious, but well played by that actor. I think probably another local Omaha, or at least Nebraska actor.
I remember he was in Heroes. He's still acting, and I remember recognizing him as an adult in the show Heroes, and he's done other things since then.
Well, speaking of the actors, we've mostly covered Broderick's career, but Reese Witherspoon, I want to mention these movies because I think this is such an important part of her career when she was not just getting started. She was in a movie called Man in the Moon, I think it was called, not Man on the Moon, Man in the Moon, in 1991 when she was very young. But she was in a movie called Freeway, which nobody saw in 1996. You want to get shot a whole bunch of times? One of the lines that should have been nominated by the AFI Quotes List. You have to see the movie to get the context, but I think it's one of the great lines. And she is a tough, awesome character in that. Certainly not a hero. Pleasantville, supporting part in 1998, one of my favorites. I've talked about that movie lots of times in our podcast. And then this, what a great run of movies those were. But this is the one that set her up as a star, I think.
Along with Cruel Intentions, I think.
Oh, true. I
forgot that was a hit.
That's right, because the other movies weren't really hits, were they? But you could see that she had that quality of not being likable, but also being likable, partly because she's good looking. Never hurts if you're good looking.
She's cute too.
Yep. But in Pleasantville, she plays both the bad girl and then later on the good girl. Freeway, she's mostly a victim, but she's also not a good girl. And in this, she's, as we said, trying to do the right thing in her own mind, but she's not always doing the right thing.
She's so good that she's intolerable.
Yep.
I read a great interview with her where they asked her what the secret to doing good comedy was. And she said that early in her career, when she was a teenager, she was in a movie. It was a serious movie. It may have been Freeway, I'm not sure. But she said that there was a scene that she played dead serious, and it was an emotional scene, and she was overreacting, and she just overdid it. But in her mind, she was playing it dead straight. And she said they went back and watched the dailies, and everybody was cracking up because she was overreacting. And it dawned on her then that the secret to comedy acting is commitment.
Yeah, of course.
Election is a great example of commitment. She's never winky. She is always fully committed to being this tightly wound overachiever. And actually, that would be a great way to describe Chris Klein's performance as well, because he's always committed to being this dopey, doe-eyed, dumb, lucky guy.
I never winking at the camera saying, I get it, I'm Mr. Cool Guy, actually.
If you're going to overdo it, you just still overdo it, but you err on the side of sincerity. And your character always believes it.
Well, and Witherspoon did win the Oscar for Walk the Line in 2005, which is not her best performance, but that's the one that got her the big award. I think she could have won it before that, although I guess she wouldn't have been nominated for this, but she would have been worthy. I think, just like Naomi Watts, we said a few weeks ago on Mulholland Drive, she's one of those unsung heroes in Hollywood. Is she thought of as a star? Yes. Is she thought of as enough of a star? Maybe Witherspoon more so than Watts, but I don't know that she is.
Yeah, she may get movies greenlit, but she's not going to get a huge budget for film just because of her name.
Well, speaking of name, the last name in this movie, Tracy Flick, of course, looks like fuck, especially when written in capitals, and especially on those cupcakes, and I'm sure that's incredibly deliberate. Jessica Campbell, who does play Tammy, Paul's sister, was only in two other movies and then also in two episodes of one of my favorite TV shows, Freaks and Geeks. I read online that Thora Birch was in this movie at one point and then dropped out after differences with the director, Payne. I'm guessing she would have been playing Campbell's part.
I think it was in that same XO Jane article I read. They said that there was an actress who was underage at the time who had to drop out because I think her parents were supposed to get a different version of the script, and they got the proper version of the script, which included the lesbian sex scene and the porno scene. When the parents saw that, instead of the script that they had been receiving, they pulled her out. So I wonder if that was Thora
Birch. If that was Thora Birch, then she went on in the very same year to do American Beauty.
Right,
where see
yeah,
her
that doesn't add
naked
up, does it? Yeah, that's true.
So he's actually showing off skin that she wouldn't have had to show off if she played Tammy. And then Phil Reeves, who plays the principal, he did a lot of movies with Payne, or has done a lot of movies with Payne, and he's now on Veep, one of the many supporting players with one of the great comic actresses who's ever lived, Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
In a cast of some of the best comic actors working today.
Mm-hmm. So the director of this film, Alexander Payne, did About Schmidt, one of my favorites, a couple years later. Sideways won the Oscar. I didn't love that movie as much. A lot of people did. The Descendants, I think that also won an Oscar, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's got two. And then Nebraska, and so many of his movies have been set in Nebraska, Omaha specifically a lot of the time. But there he did a movie with Bruce Dern and Will Forte. That was actually literally just called Nebraska, and we liked it quite a lot. We saw that on the
big
screen.
Yeah, that was a great movie.
Mm-hmm. He uses so many tricks in this movie. Multiple voiceover, the freeze frames, flashbacks. It is a very gimmicky movie for something that seems pretty straight ahead.
But the gimmicks work.
Oh, I'm not criticizing. I'm just saying that you kind of forget to watch the movie again. And when we watch so many movies in a row like this for the podcast, but just movies in general, we see the great filmmakers like the Tarantinos and the PTAs and the Scorseses, who can be gimmicky, but in the right way. They don't overuse it. They don't misuse it. And here's somebody who's not thought of on their level. Maybe he should be in a lesser way, more of a low-budget kind of just people just acting type movies rather than the big-budget stuff that Scorsese and Tarantino tend to get, or bigger than he gets, at least. But his resume is pretty awesome, and he does have more gimmicks than you might think. His co-writer on this is Jim Taylor. They wrote a lot of things together. The producers were a lot of people. We get one of those movies where you've got about 5 or 8 people that have producing credit. The movie is 2 through 5 to 1. We watched a spotty DVD. I was hoping it was on Netflix because probably that would be the Blu-ray quality copy, but it's not on there. So we had to see a DVD that was just barely acceptable. The cinematographer, James Glennon, did About Schmidt and then also went on to do Deadwood, a TV series I've never seen, but I'm sure is pretty outstanding looking because it's a Western and those are one of the easiest things to shoot when you want to get that, man, what a great cinematographer credit for yourself. The editor, Kevin Ten, has cut everything by Payne. He also did Blow in 2001. And the music is Rolf Kent, who works a lot with Payne, but also did the Legally Blonde flicks. So he has seen Reese Witherspoon's face plenty on those composing studios when they do their music.
I wonder if he composed that great war chant, which is one of the defining little gimmicks of the film.
Mm-hmm. And there's also a music cue that Tarantino used in, I think, the Kill Bill movies. Navajo Joe, it's called. It's part of that poster ripping down sequence. Mm-hmm. When she's doing that, I think it's the very beginning of it, but during there at some point there's a music cue, and I'd read that before I saw the movie this time, and then when you hear it you think, oh yeah, of course, yeah, you know, yeah, you recognize it. There's not a ton of influence. I mentioned already that this probably solidified Reese Witherspoon as a star, and it also put Payne on the map after Citizen Ruth, and look at the filmography he now has About Schmidt, working with Nicholson a couple years later, that got him a nomination and Kathy Bates a nomination.
Yeah, he's a must-see director as far as I'm concerned. I always want to see what he does.
And he does things that are different every time and works with different actors. He will cast the Phil Reeves types to be supporting players, and then his technicians, which is typical for most directors, has credits with him over and over again, but his main cast has changed most of the time now. He worked with people like Clooney and Nicholson, Paul Giamatti, not a star, but in Sideways, and then, of course, Dern and Forte in Nebraska. Every one of those guys is different. I don't think any of them ever worked with him again. I'm not saying they didn't want to or didn't have the opportunity to, but kind of Kubrick-esque, his star changes every time.
Well, and you should cast people that are appropriate for the role rather than working a role to accommodate an actor that you're buddies with that you just like and want to work with again.
Clooney wanted to play the supporting part in Sideways, the goofy friend. I forget the name of the guy who played him now.
Thomas Hayden Church.
That's it. But they thought he was wrong for it, and then he ends up being the star of The Descendants. I think he's wrong for it, too.
Yeah.
But then he's the star of the movie that is made a few years later, so obviously Payne didn't forget about him, although it's not like he's a nobody. He was and is one of the biggest stars in the business. The other influence, I mentioned this a minute ago about the Job arc. I think maybe A Serious Man might be tied in with this movie in some ways. The main character has a very similar arc.
Yes.
When everything goes down on him, everything really goes down on him.
Yeah, well, he doesn't deserve it. That's kind of the point of A Serious Man, is that bad things do happen to good people. It's funny you say that. It's like a movie where there's a character who does everything right, and yet the second he gives in and does one wrong thing, everything comes really crashing down on him. It's not my favorite Coen films by any means, but even though I don't necessarily enjoy it, I think about it all the time. Such an interesting movie.
I think I'll watch it again. I guess I've seen it twice. And it's worth watching another time, probably, because it's not entertaining. It's not funny like Fargo or Big Lebowski.
No. Scene by scene, it's very engaging, though.
Yeah. I think it's deeper than I thought it was the first time. I didn't think it was shallow, but I didn't realize how deep it might be actually is. Just like Election has more depth than you maybe think the first time. Because you're caught up in the comedy of this one, and you're caught up in the seriousness of a serious man.
I think that when the BBC did that list of the best films of the century so far, I think Serious Man was like 68 or something. Okay. It was in the bottom half of that list, but it did make the list.
Yeah, okay. Election's only credit of any kind with awards and lists is it was nominated for the adapted screenplay, which it lost out to Cider House Rules, as I recall, in 1999, which is a fine screenplay, I guess, but this would have been a better choice.
I agree.
Luckily, Payne and Taylor won later on for other movies, but this is, if not their very best movie, I love about Schmidt. This is probably a better movie, actually. So if I had to pick one Payne movie on the shelf and no other ones, I guess it'd be Election.
I agree. It's my favorite Payne film.
Before we wrap up, is one of the things I want to mention. And you did it in the Sparkplug sponsor. Good job on that, by the way. Mentioning the guy, I think it's Reggie Meeks. You said Reggie Banks. I think it's Reggie Meeks that she references. I always thought that was a great moment by Payne and Taylor and Perrott on the novel, probably, and sold well by Witherspoon. But it's so bogus when politicians do that. It's the Joe the Plumber thing. It's that name dropping of somebody who doesn't matter. Reggie Meeks told me this. It just seems so fucking stupid.
Yeah.
But I think that they're all on to why it's stupid. I'm not criticizing the movie, but just when politicians do that.
Because that's what we hate about all brown nosers. They're phony. That's why we hate know-it-alls, because they're arrogant, and we hate ass-kissers like Tracy Flick because we know she's putting it on. We know that she's just intellectually performing the part of a person who's doing the proper things, and the movie illustrates very well that underneath that veneer, she feels contempt for just about everybody at Carver.
But you know the irony, we keep comparing her to Hillary Clinton, and whenever you hear the stories lately from people who don't hate her, or just abjectly love her, the ones who can be a little more objective, the ones that know her pretty well.
People who've worked with her.
Yeah.
Know her.
Will say that she has been a dedicated politician. For whatever flaws she has, she's cared about people. I don't think there's any doubt, and you believe what you want to about the other guy. He doesn't give a shit about anybody.
Yeah. And people who've worked for her are fiercely loyal to her, and they will all say the same thing, which is that she's an exceptional listener. Mm. She's exceptionally smart and competent.
I think she would hear the Reggie Meeks thing if, let's say, it was a guy who had a real case, not some high school student. The taxes in my area are too high, or the potholes are a problem, or whatever it is that's a serious issue maybe for him. And she maybe would remember that guy and actually name drop him in the sense of, maybe if I can, I'll try to help him out, rather than just mention his name on the campaign trail, and then he never matters again. Mm-hmm. Joe the Plumber became famous because both Obama and McCain were referencing him. And it seems so phony, and then the guy became famous for all the wrong reasons. But if it hadn't been for the fact that his name took off, neither of them would have thought about him again. And I don't think Obama, I don't think McCain's a bad person. At least he wasn't back in 2008. But that's just what politicians do. And it just is one of the great moments in this film. It's such a small thing. But I think they really captured that about when people run for president or run for any kind of office, that they name drop. And those names mean shit.
And another great moment, and one of the things that gives Tracy Flick the pathos that she needs for you to stick with her for the whole film, is after she thinks that she's lost the election and she's crying to her mother, and her mom just can't resist saying, maybe if you had made those changes to your speech that I suggested.
It is a weak speech. It's such a,
it's totally a weak
typical
speech.
Politician's kind of speech.
But I just say that to remark on the illustration that Tracy, who lives with her single mother, is just the two of them against the world. And her mother is definitely pushing her to be this person.
It's never
as well.
Enough. It's never good enough.
Yeah.
Although when we see Tracy at the end with the politician, an actual politician from Nebraska, I guess, in the time, she seems to be happy.
Well, how can you tell?
Well, she could be
putting
on.
She actually seems less wound up in that scene. She's maybe finally found
she's
her
in her
people.
Element. Just like for whatever Jim could say was life went to shit. He's in his element. He is teaching in New York City. That's pretty
damn
cool.
He's got a new girlfriend and everything.
And somebody he likes, yeah.
I would live in a shoebox apartment for the chance to like live in Manhattan and work at the Natural History
Museum.
This
is the movie that lets our main characters all be happier. Tammy's certainly happier in the all-girls school. Paul's always going to be happy. He's one of those kinds of characters like we talked about Jerry O'Connell in Stand By Me. They talk about having some job at a school. He's just driving a forklift. But I think that'd be enough for Vern in that movie. So much like Vern and all of these characters, they seem to have actually had everything work out for them. And most of these characters, certainly our two leads, probably didn't deserve that.
But don't we all deserve that second chance? Because we're all these people. We are all these people who think we're better than we are. I love that the movie ends on a happy note. It's not perfect that everybody doesn't get exactly what they want, but they end up happy with what they get.
Who the fuck does she think she is?
Amazing.
All right, well, wrap up your last thoughts on Election, Bev. A great choice. You made it, and I am so glad you did.
I am super disappointed that the AFI never even nominated this on like the comedies list.
At the very least, yeah.
At the very least. It disappoints me that it seems like critical bodies don't really recognize this as a great comedy, even though it kind of has a cult level of popularity, and it's certainly been well remembered by a lot of people, the character of Tracy Flick especially. I desperately hope that someday people take a look back and recognize this for the masterpiece that it is, because it's not just one of the best comedies of the 90s, it's one of the best comedies ever made. The writing is so good, the performances, there's just lightning in a bottle in this film.
And that was one of my favorite years, like I said earlier, in general, but also for comedy movies, like Bowfinger, like Dogma. This, Toy Story 2, is comedic, not really a comedy, I guess. All of them have something else going on other than just, maybe not so much Bowfinger, although I do love it, but there's something deeper going on, especially Dogma, obviously. This is not my favorite of all of those. It's not my favorite of that year. I had to have a top 30 for that year. I couldn't pick one or two or 10 or 20 years for films. And Election is one of the better ones as the century ended. When you hear our voices, hopefully mine will be much better. In 7 days on the next 100 project, we'll be covering our third foreign film of the year. We said we were going to do some this year, and that'll be three. Actually, we're going to cover three foreign films at once. It's Krzysztof Kieślowski's Three Colors trilogy, Bleu, Blanc, et Rouge, and we've now watched them all. So the coming attraction trivia for the Three Colors trilogy. Who's the most recent Best Director Oscar nominee or winner whose film was primarily in a foreign language? Because Krzysztof Kieślowski was nominated for Best Director up against Tarantino, Zemeckis, and others, and of course Zemeckis won in 1994 for Forrest Gump. Not a ton of guys have been nominated as director for a foreign language film, but who's the most recent?
Oh, I can think of something, but I don't know if it counts. Anyway, for the answer to that question, please check out next week's podcast. And in the meantime, if you'd like more from Ryan and me, please check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. And while you're there, you can check out our entire roster of podcasts. We've covered 180-something movies, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 98 and 2007 lists of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free, and while you're there, please rate us and review us. It helps people find us. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. And once more, we would like to warmly thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
So in honor of the movie Election, vote tomorrow if you're an American. Vote the right way. Even if that's not the way we agree with, vote the way you want to. Don't just do some protest stuff. Vote for the person you think is going to be best for your country. And I'm getting a little didactic here. I've also said enough. My voice needs some serious help. But anyway, thanks for listening, and we'll see you in a week with Three Colors Trilogy.
And cut.